Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's again a beautiful, lovely weather and blue skies out of my new, brand new window, a brand new Ice Cream HQ in London. However, at the same time, not so great news. I mean, at the time I'm recording this and by the time it's published, we'll probably have more details. Extremely sad news coming from right next door, right next to the other side of the channel from Brussels. Bomb attacks at the airport and in the metro, an awful number of injured and dead people as I'm recording this. So my thoughts, of course, go to the people in Brussels and everywhere else, the families and close ones, the people that are no longer with us. One more horrible, horrible event. I mean, I remember how it touched me, the events in Paris only a few months ago, right? And I grew up in Paris, and a lot of these attacks happen right next door, and Brussels is right next door, and it's the heart of all the political Europe. So, you know, I don't care. As I said, this is not particularly about current events. This podcast is not about that, but it's another terrifying terror attack. And I guess beyond thoughts and well wishes to the people in Brussels and everywhere around and all their families and close ones, to the victims, all I can say is don't fall into the hate and fear mongering trap. Some are almost certainly already, by the time this is published, there's already going to be some people talking about it. Certainly use that hate and fear mongering. Well, the people who led these attacks, these terror attacks to start with, because that's their main methodology. That's what they want. They want people to react in hate and fear so that it justifies more what they're doing. And other people are certainly going to be using that to their own political and public promotional advantages. So, you know, don't fall into that trap. Let's just be together. I know that there's not really anything more to say about this. It's a horrible, horrible event. It's horrible. They're becoming increasingly normal. I don't even know how to react because you're seeing that through the lens of the news, seeing that through the lens of a few videos online and tweets. And it's so close and so far away, but yeah, so that's all I have to say about that. There's not really much. I just want to acknowledge the fact that we live in a world where there's horrible events going on. I don't think this one is more or less horrible than what's been going on in other countries such as Mali, and of course what's going on in Syria. So all of them are equally horrible. So I'm not trying to say one place is more deserving of horrible attention than another. But that's just the main piece of news that's happening right now that I'm seeing updated in the mainstream news. So that's the one that's affecting and talking about right now. So just at the time of recording, I don't promise I'm going to talk about current events all the time, but I kind of like record these intros talking about what's happening. So that's what's happening right now. But anyway, on to today's show, back to the blue skies and the weather and interesting stuff to talk about. One day I might have a guest that's more knowledgeable about current politics or even terrorism to talk about that kind of stuff or communicating in that environment. But for now, let's keep to our usual topics. And, if ever you're listening to this for the first time, this is a show that's got nothing to do with terror attacks and it's got nothing to do with politics. It's got nothing to do with all that stuff or very little to do with that anyway, so far. And in the show, I interview creators and thinkers from a variety of different backgrounds that I'm either both, well, professionally and personally interested in. So I'm a marketing and brand strategist. So the people I interview tend to work in planning and strategy and advertising, marketing and media. And I'm also a keen tabletop gamer. So I love board games, tabletop games, role-playing games. I love video games and all kinds of play and game formats. So I interview game designers and find out about their inspiration as well. You can find the show on all the usual podcast channels. I mean, I don't know how you're listening right now. It could be iTunes, could be Stitcher. If you do check the show out on those, or please leave a rating and a review. If you enjoy the show, listen to one episode, at least one, two ideally, or even three while we're at it. Let's go crazy. And if you enjoy it, check out iTunes. Even if you don't use iTunes, you got to have iTunes. Check out iTunes or Stitcher. And leave a rating or review. It really helps other people find the show, and I would be enormously, hugely grateful if you do that. Of course, you can also find all the episodes and a lot more ice cream goodies on my website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. And you can also find my weekly long-form email newsletter, which I encourage you to sign up to. So there's a variety of topics happening every week. It changes every week. It's called Ice Cream Sunday and comes out, of course, every Sunday. And I usually have a mix of like kind of personal experiences and then expand from there in a variety of different topics. You can contact me if you have any questions or if you'd like to find out more about the show or if you're looking for a strategist or if you're looking for advice for on how to grow your brand or how to market your products or how to launch a new product from a marketing perspective, I'd be happy to help you. You can email me from the website. You can get in touch via Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at I'm at HippoWill on Twitter. And that's about it for the shameless promotion. Let's move on to talking about our guest today. Our guest today is Richard Huntington. Richard is the group strategy officer for Saatchi & Saatchi, a global advertising agency. And he also writes and comments about the advertising and marketing industry and planning in his blog, Ad Literate. He's got a variety of fantastic articles, even though he says he's not. I find him always extremely interesting. He both exposes a lot of different points of views about what's going on in marketing and advertising. Really, really smart stuff. And he's always great to talk to, extremely enthusiastic about a variety of different ideas and about the industry altogether. Great storyteller. I caught up with Richard at the European Planning Conference in Prague, where we were both talking a few months ago. And on the occasion, I asked if he'd be up for being on the podcast. So we met up in London. Had a fantastic conversation about how Richard got into planning and advertising, how he started in direct marketing, his early website design skills for the society or club that he created with friends from university that they had fun together with at university. So there's that, and that was quite fun. We talked about a few different hot topics in advertising and marketing, like ad blockers and content marketing. And of course, we talked about tabletop games and gaming towards the end of the episode as well. So, without further ado, here's Richard Huntington. Enjoy. Welcome to the show. Thank you very much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. It's great to see you again.
Oh, it's good to see you, mate.
Yeah. So, I usually start these interviews with a warm-up question. And the warm-up question, it's half the time kind of just an excuse to mention something that I've found randomly while doing some research. And in this case, this is where the internet is really, really good sometimes. I looked up your LinkedIn profile. I did a bit of stalking around. I didn't do as much like back reading of Ad Literate as I would have liked, but you know. And I found out that while you're studying in Cambridge, you're a part of a society called the Minotaurs.
Yes.
Minotaurs?
Yes. Yes.
That apparently was self-proclaimed to promote, what does it say again? The idea was, apparently.
No! You can't do this!
So what was it about, and why did you call yourselves like that?
Oh, I do know, I mean, this is 30 years ago, and I think we were just a bunch of people at St. John's College, Cambridge, who weren't invited to be part of any of the sort of posh dining clubs that sort of seemed to be, you know, in vogue. And I mean, I guess currently have some infamy because of the antics of David Cameron and George Osborne at Oxford. So we created our own dining club, and it sounds really pathetic, but Matt, we were like 20, 21. You've got to forgive us for that. But I do still, I'm still quite close to lots of those people who I met at the time. I mean, I'd love to. We used to go skiing together, actually. It was really, really good fun. But anyway, so that was really deep, dark past, and God knows how you found that. Aren't there things
do you remember
can do
why
now to eradicate your sort of online history?
I have worse. Because there's a website.
Is there?
Yes, there is a website with photos from
no!
And there's a description.
Okay.
I think there's deniability, if ever, because it says Dickie Huntington.
Yes.
As the description of one of the members.
Yes.
Dickie is a planner and partner at Howell Henry Chaldicott Lurie, an ad agency in London, oh so fashionable Soho. Actually says that. He drinks a lot of cappuccino, and like the rest of the agency, goes around pretending he didn't go to Oxbridge by wearing combat trousers and looking like an absolute oik. He doesn't believe in marriage, but is weighing up procreation against holidays, building a roof terrace, and not smelling of sick. He has got rid of his stupid haircut. Dickie is haunted by a blur of no hands bumpering, recitals of the letter, and bad dancing. Oxford One was a particular highlight as he woke up in the room of a student whose college we had invaded and who he had never met before. While on the skiing front, Teeny One stands out for sheer vileness.
I mean, I wrote this shit.
Did you wrote
this? Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure I wrote that. Like, I don't know, 15 years ago. This has got to be the beginning of the internet. I'm like trying to crane my neck.
Wait, I'll show you the website.
These
are photos. Yeah. I don't know if they're coming later.
Well, no, but look at that. It's sort of internet circa 1998, isn't it?
Just finding the website was fantastic. So I'm not connected with it. So the website has got a pink and blue kind of like theme, which is, I mean, the website's amazing. It is definitely 1.0 or 0.0.
Yeah,
I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
But it's great. It's like good effort. Do you remember why the name Minotaurs?
I don't really.
No?
I don't really know why. We had sort of a, I mean, we got as far as having a bow tie that was in Minotaurs colours. I mean, so it had its own sort of identity. But it wasn't one of those things that, you know, a lot of those dining clubs are perpetuated from generation to generation. That was just something that we did, and thank goodness, I think, has died a death.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's backtrack a little bit further. Where are you from? Where did you grow up?
I guess I grew up mainly in the southwest of England, in Devon and Somerset. I mean, I was born in Kent in the southeast, but I kind of moved to Devon and Somerset in the when I was around 7, and I sort of did my growing up there, particularly in Devon. And my father was a farmer, and we'd moved to so he could look after a really interesting state in South Devon, which had been created in the 30s as a sort of utopian rural community called Dartington. And we moved there, and I was very influenced, I think, by growing up in a slightly countercultural sort of 70s environment, most of which I then spent the following 10 years kind of rebelling against.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what were your interests growing up? What kind of child were you?
Well, it's interesting because now I have a 12-year-old. I kind of think, oh my goodness, I went to his parents' evening last night. I went, he is me, poor sod. So I introverted, very self-aware. I really adored drawing and cartoons in particular, although I recently, my eldest found a book of cartoons I'd drawn when I was about his age, and he redrew them all. Much better.
Really?
Which, yeah, it was a massive slap in the face. So that sort of stuff, you know, I was just a very normal 70s kid, very influenced. My parents sort of dropped out from their careers in the early 80s when I was around 15, and we moved, and they became they role reversed for one thing, and they became very self-reliant, and I sort of I grew up in quite a tight and closely knit family, which I always think, you know, didn't exactly wasn't conducive to rebelling properly as a kid. I always wonder whether that was a bit of a mistake. And then I was, you know, obviously spent a lot of time working very hard, got myself to Cambridge, which really wasn't likely because I'm profoundly stupid, or at least was at that time. And then I sort of, you know, it kind of unfolded from there.
Did you work hard as an ambition to get to Cambridge? Or?
Well, I was just at one level I was just...
Or at a good school?
No. I mean, I was dreadful rural comprehensives, which, you know, I think actually state education is brilliant in Britain right now, but it was terrible in the 80s. So I was a bit stupid. So it took a long time for me to kind of click, but I did... For my A levels, so I worked really fucking hard. I was going to go and do product design or packaging design, and a geography teacher said, "Oh, if you the geography, go to Cambridge. And I went, oh, that sounds like a good idea. So that's really how that all happened. And so I think I'm pretty much the only person who went to Cambridge. I have 3 A-levels, one in design, what was it? Subject called craft design technology. You know, I mean, most people that had like 15 A levels, all in double maths. Right. I had a very bizarre collection of qualifications. I'm not really sure I should have been there at all. And I only say all of that because I think the mess that is sort of my background. I mean, it's not a sort of, you know, a social mess or like I came, you know, I had a tough upbringing or anything like that. But I have just this sort of random jumble of influences and qualifications and things, and I think that makes for sort of interesting planner fodder. If that makes it's not very traditional.
Yeah. Do you remember a first time or a reason why you got interested in product design when you were studying?
Yeah, I mean, well, I can tell you exactly. I fancied myself as a designer. I mean, I think I genuinely just fancied myself as a designer because I did design O level. That was the forerunner to GCSEs in the UK, and I failed. You know, so God knows why I thought I should go on do A level. But I found this subject that looked kind of cool. It was a combination of sort of practical making the stuff that you design and sort of theory that worked really well for me. And then this is 1983, and I was reading a magazine, and I read this story about this British designer called James Dyson, who was struggling to get a product off the ground and had managed to do a deal with a Japanese. Basically, I mean, as we know, it's like a legendary story now. I've been rejected by every single vacuum cleaner manufacturer, and he managed to license the product, initially the Cyclone vacuum cleaner in Japan. Mm-hmm. And it was great sort of early 80s design because it was pink and grey. He then went on, I guess by 93, to manufacture the Dyson himself. And it was really that made me think, I want to do product design as opposed to graphic design, you know, product design, industrial design. And that was really what I wanted to do for quite a long time until I sort of, and I do sometimes look back and go, gosh, you know, because you have those moments in your life where there were decisions, and you may not have sat down and made really weighty decision about it, but you made a decision and it does, you know, it does influence your life path. But yeah. You know,
was the direction of like going into from account management to planning, was that one of those decisions?
Yeah, and I really kicked against it, which is bizarre because, you know, I thought I was working in a direct marketing agency. We all have our, you know, CD backgrounds. And I was an account handler. I was absolutely dreadful. I mean, awful, awful account handler.
In what ways?
Well, you know, I think I think one of the great qualities of an account handler is decisiveness. I had absolutely none. It makes me quite a good planner. And the other thing is I hate making difficult phone calls. And clearly that's a massive part of telling, you know, phoning up the client, telling them that the whole project's gone tits up and getting away with it. It seems to be a occupational hazard of being an account handler. It's terrible at all of that. And it was really my agency at the time, a place called Barraclough Hall, Wollstone Grey, which became Proximity in London.
Okay.
They kind of went, they didn't actually say you're a useless account handler, but they did in a slightly passive aggressive way say, well, why don't you go to an agency called Abbott Mead Vickers and learn to be a planner? And I went, yeah, but you know, I'm an account manager in direct marketing. I mean, I'd be an account director and I wouldn't ever have got, you know, very shortly, I need to pursue my career in direct marketing. So I was definitely in the kind of realms of looking a gift horse in the mouth. And eventually they packed me off. And I did 6 months learning to be a planner at Abbott Mead in the mid-90s. And clearly I had absolutely, once I'd done that, no intention.
How did you learn it? Was it shadowing another planner or?
Well, I think genuinely in the way that the lots of us learn, which is I just got thrown into the deep end. I mean, nobody at Abbott Mead wanted me there. I was just like, you know, bloke that turned up from a direct marketing agency they just happened to have recently bought. Nobody was the slightest bit interested. I was like, I felt made because I was, you know, having Mead at long last. It'd been a long time. I had a, you know, been rejected by them and the, when I originally applied. Now it's bad. You know, I felt like the place to be. But it, like all of that, you sort of dig around, you try and be useful, you try then to end up being invaluable. By the end of that time, and my allotted 6 months, I'd sort of created, I mean, I dug away on an account they had at the time, Delta Airlines, and made it difficult for them to send me back.
Yeah.
The only brave thing I've ever done in my career was I went to the head of planning at the time and said, I'd like to be a planner here. And she said, we'll never poach people from sister agencies. So I went back to Barrack of Hall, Austin Gray, and resigned. Then went back to her and said, I don't work for a sister agency any longer. It's about the only brave thing I've ever done in a very kind of lackluster career, frankly.
I don't think it's that lackluster.
Well, I don't know.
You're probably exaggerating a little bit here. I mean, you are the chief strategy officer at Saatchi & Saatchi.
Yes.
Like, you know, historical agency. One of the only agency names that people who don't work in advertising have actually heard of.
Yes, which is a, you know, as much a millstone as it is a sort of, you know, a boost for us. I think inhabiting such a famous brand actually gives us a little bit of empathy with clients managing brands that perhaps have a bunch of great associations and a bunch of less great associations.
Mm-hmm. And you write a lot as well. So we mentioned Adliterate, and this is one of the things a lot of people in the industry know you for.
Yes.
How did you start writing for and commenting about the industry? Like, and where did the idea of blogging come about?
Well, I mean, in all honesty, I mean, remember it really, really well. I did a talk, I think called the Financial Services Forum, and I was pitted as the advertising representative against a guy from Digital, who turned out to be Mark Cridge, the founder of Glue, now Isobar, and somebody from PR and somebody from Direct. And it was, you know, it was a kind of debate on where should clients be spending their money. And I made a very unfashionable at the time, and probably still unfashionable, plea that the vast majority of their budget should be in advertising. And I went really hard on it, and I was really proud of it, this talk. I mean, you turn up, I don't know, it happens to you, but sometimes you turn up and you're sort of imagining that in your mind's eye there'll be 200 people sitting in front of you, you know, eagerly anticipating your every word. And I think I probably spoke to 30 people, like, and I thought, okay, fine. And then I just knew nobody was ever going to phone up the agency or talk to me. And I got frustrated. There is a point to this eventually, you know, I'd done all that work and it was just going to disappear into the ether. So I thought, well, what could I find a way to put stuff in a searchable place where possibly other people would come across it? And at the time, rather arrogantly, I thought, well, you know, journalists can find this stuff, like it would be at all interesting. I went back to the agency and said, how do you build a website? And the person in charge of IT at the time, this is HHCL, so we had IT people who were interested in technology, which is very unusual in advertising these days. He said, well, it'd be thousands of pounds, and blah, blah, blah. And I got really dispirited. And then a friend of mine just said, no, there's this blogging software, it's free. I had a movable type blog at the time. Just do that. Well, it's brilliant. So I never intended to start a blog. I wanted just a sort of searchable place to put stuff. So it was never, in a way a blog. And I guess originally I feel people felt frustrated because I would maybe write twice a month. And I remember having a conversation with Russell Davis, you know, legendary Adland blogger, you know, at the time when he would say, I've been advised I have to post twice a day. I can imagine that now. Wow, I mean, that's what, you know, microblogging has been invented for. So I never did that. So I never really felt I was creating a blog. But blogging sort of came along and was the thing, you know, provided this sort of cheap, easy, updatable software. So I started doing that and it started to have a life of its own. I mean, and the name
is... Do you
have
a structure in terms of the way that you prepare posts or write them?
Now?
Now, or that has evolved over the past, like, however many years?
No, I mean, and I, you know, in fairness, because I've started March 2005, so it's now 11 years of this. In fairness, it's really difficult. I made this pact that I would only post my own work. I've once done a guest post, but my own work, and it would have to be something where I had an original, or I thought original, point of view. And it didn't matter whether it was, in a sense, whether I really believed it or not. The point was the provocation. Okay. And so really, you know, I sort of, when there's stuff that pops into my mind, then I get excited and write. But that's why it can seem slightly sort of spasmodic in its frequency. I mean, there are some disciplines now. I tend to want to write 600 words. I think it's if you're writing, I find the word count brilliant, because it disciplines you. I tend to.
Do you have any techniques for like note taking when you have ideas for something?
No, and it should be much better, because I definitely do shit like, I think that'd be brilliant, and then completely forget what it was. And so I don't. Lots of people do that, but I mean I don't do that. I tend to have an idea, start writing, to be honest, and often what I'm writing about becomes apparent during that process, and sometimes. I end up writing something completely different to the thing I'd started. I mean, not in its subject matter, but possibly the point of view. And I still love it. I think that I'm a generation of people, maybe it's got worse, that, you know, left school able to write and then were de-skilled by the industry because we only ever communicated in PowerPoint. Yeah. And the art of writing's lost. I find it real. I really struggle with younger planners now. Not necessarily a generational thing. Just they're not very good at writing. It frustrates me enormously. I took George Orwell as sort of a hero anyway, but as this model for writing. He wrote prolifically, and he also wrote prolifically about writing. And a lot of the style is actually taken from his belief in brevity, his loathing of tired and dead metaphor, all that sort of stuff. So I kind of, in presentation, I try to channel Ezzy Izzard, and in writing, I try and channel George Orwell, which is
saw that Eddie Izzard was live a few weeks ago. I didn't have a chance.
He's back on stage. Yeah. I mean, I think,
have you seen the latest show, or is it a remix of some previous stuff or new material? Do you know?
I think it's pretty much new material. But all the reviews I've have read, it's a slight parody of Eddie Izzard. I mean, it's Eddie Izzard doing Eddie Izzard, I think that's you know. But he's a legend, though. I mean, yeah. You know, he's doing 27 marathons simultaneously or consecutively in South Africa at the moment for Sport Relief. I mean, he is a legend. But I think I always tried. I just picked up a desire to channel him. I mean, that's really arrogant. I didn't really mean I am trying to be Eddie Izzard. But
if we were to talk
about you know, writing style or presenting style, I don't think it harms to look at people and go, I want to write a bit more like that, or I want to present a bit more like that. Yeah.
So you were saying that some of the young planners are.
Dreadful at writing.
Yeah. Okay, fine, let's just say it. It's easier. And one of the things they should do is read some George Orwell.
Yes, yes.
Anybody else they should be reading that you think would be really useful?
Well, read. I mean, I think read great columnists, you know, people whose job it is to communicate a point of view in 600 words or less. I think being proud and enjoying writing. I mean, I don't know how you find it, but so there is, of course, the tyranny of having to write.
Yeah.
But there's a joy in writing. Yeah. And there's also, I'm sorry, but there's a joy in rereading your work and thinking, yeah that was all right. Yeah. You know,
I really enjoy it. And I've started writing a weekly newsletter.
Right.
Because actually that was one of the things I wasn't very, discipline with my blog at all. I just kept thinking I need to post to my blog, but I'm not doing it. And then I thought, all right, well, if I start an email and I have people expecting it at a certain time, yeah, and a certain date, then I'm gonna do that. And I now have that rhythm, that every Sunday at 12, my newsletter goes out. Like whatever sun, rain or shine, my newsletter goes out at that time. And it tends to be a long form, newsletter. Yeah. So 1500 to 2000 words.
Well, okay.
It's not a rule. It just happened to be that way.
But I think so. People have their right, you know, their right length. You know, some people are great at 400. I just really love the discipline of 600.
Yeah.
But I mean, because you're getting into essay territory
into essay territory.
1,200. Yeah. You know, and I think that's also an art form that's sort of been lost. Ian Leslie, great planner, does a lot of longer form, long read writing, particularly on politics. So sometimes I think sitting down or Malcolm Gladwell was one, you know, the daddy of the essay,
yeah,
particularly for New Yorker. I mean, I've never got to that. I mean, there's another person. If I could do that thing, what I love about Malcolm Gladwell is it'll be a story about, I don't know, he'll be writing about parenting,
yeah,
but he'll start with a story about, you know, in Venezuela in 1926, there was a diamond mine, you know, like where, and I can't do
it.
It
links it all together.
Oh, man.
I can do that, but not for very, I want to get better at it. I can do that, but I can right now do it for personal experiences, not for very thoughtful things about the industry or about marketing or about brands or like, yeah, certainly not like Gladwell. What do you think is one of your main strengths as a planner?
I talk about this too much and it's too cliched, but I think one of the great skills of a planner is to be able to see the world differently, and that's a cliche, and have a more interesting point of view on something that's very familiar. Most of the time, we're being presented with brands or categories that are very familiar to consumers, and our job, in a way, is to defamiliarize them.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a lot of work at the moment on HSBC, particularly around wealth management. And I find it fascinating because I don't think that there is a category that is more deluged in orthodox thinking than financial services. I think it's because people in our industry don't understand it, and people in their industry can't explain it. And so most work is trite and tired and boring, and, you know, retirement is always about passions, and, you know, investments are always about nest eggs, because nobody has got the wit, intellect or interest to do anything differently. And I sort of say all of that because I think my job is sort of go in and take all of those subjects and find a different perspective. And I think that's ultimately, yes, planners are there to structure and discipline and simplify and do all those great things that we do, you know, help brands and clients navigate culture and technology and all of that good stuff. But, this is the point I sort of was banging on about when we met in the European Planning Conference, but the big bucks, or at least the big sort of personal rewards, come from doing much more significant rethinking of categories or reframing of brands. So that's still, and so if you say what, if I've got anything, you know, because I don't actually genuinely believe I'm a particularly brilliant planner, but I just have a sort of desire to think something that other people haven't thought. And that's where blogging has been helpful, because it's honed that.
Yeah.
And
as you said, like the ability to express that different point of view and convince others that it's a valuable one.
Indeed. And so the whole writing thing, we need to be able to convince, you know, we need to be able to convince our agency colleagues and clients of our point of view. And so we need to be able to be persuasive in person, but I also think we need to be persuasive in other media and being able to write is a part of that. And I do think that there are times when you sit down and go, the way to explain this is in a deck. And then there are other times where you think, actually, the way to explain this is in one tightly written sheet of A4 that takes the client all the way through to the end. Because after all, you know, what are creative briefs if they're not one page of tightly written argument in that case to a creative team to convince them to pursue direction. Your direction? So writing has still got to be one of the most critical skills of a planner. And we, you know, I just think, you know, the planners out there just get better at writing.
And for people who might be, because there's also people who listen to this that are not necessarily in the advertising industry, but who might be interested in writing. And if they look to the advertising and marketing industry, what do you think they can draw as lessons in terms of their improvement of writing or improvement of like whatever, something to take in their own business?
Yeah, don't look at us right now. I think, you know, it's to our eternal shame that we let copywriting die on the vine. It still exists, I think, in some agencies which still value long form copy, particularly the direct tradition, where, you know, you take time to persuade somebody of your point of view. But, you know, I weep when I read, you know, burn back ads from the 60s. You know, I think I showed one at that conference, 43 words to convince you to buy a Volkswagen. I mean, you know, I think it's not just planners that have lost the art of writing well. It is to our great shame that creatives have as well, because we have relentlessly pursued the concept of the conceptual idea at great cost to some of the skills, the craft skills of our industry. So yes, we have some astonishing ideas. You know, and they're just extraordinary ideas, but we've lost a craft in our industry. Maybe that's because of time pressures. Maybe that's because clients no longer value it. Maybe consumers no longer value it. But I think it's sad.
Do you think, just to go over a little bit of like some of the buzzwords and conversations going around, a lot of people are worried and talking about ad blockers at the moment.
Yes.
That, you know, well, everybody is justifiably installing on their computers. Is it a concern that you're also playing with? Are you hearing a lot of conversations?
Lots of conversations. Sort of actually, in a weird way, not from clients at the moment. So clients aren't saying, well, what's the agency's point of view on ad blockers? I mean, I have a view that at the moment clients, I mean, I wrote about this last weekend, but this is a bit harsh, but that clients don't know or care where their advertising is appearing right now. So actually, I think they're woefully naive about the rise of ad blockers. The people that are talking to us about that are the publishers, because they are shitting themselves.
Yes.
The people that, you know, conversation with people from the newspaper industry recently. But I've got to say, you know, I've got to say they brought it on themselves. They've treated their readers with utter disdain. I think, you know, an unholy alliance of the ad tech industry, who've yet to prove their case, by the way. I think, you know, they seem to survive largely because there are deep pockets in venture capitalists, not actually because anybody's making any real money.
Yeah.
And publishers who were greedy, or at least panicking about print, the death of print, and agencies who've produced an absolutely woeful product. No wonder people installing ad blockers. And there's a bit of me that kind of goes, bring it on. Because, you know, I think the industry deserves being punished, for one thing. And I also think that, you know, whenever there's a decline in supply, the quality of stuff gets better. And I think that that's also possible. I do buy the argument that ad blocking is not really a kind of championing of consumer rights. It is really, I think the culture secretary in the UK described it as a scam, and I think it probably is a scam. You know, the whole culture of whitelisting and paying to be whitelisted. I mean, But anyway, I think it's a, so that was one, sorry, a long rambling answer to one thing about ad blocking. That's all where I am on ad blocking. I'd like to figure a way through, but I hate the defensiveness around ad blocking. I kind of think we brought that on ourselves.
Yeah. Another question that comes just because it's such a ridiculously common buzzword right now, and your content.
Yes.
We're all talking about content at the moment, or at least that's one of the words I see repeated and talked about all over and over and over again. And everybody is hailing it as the answer to everything, also because it's a catch-all phrase or catch-all word that can mean just about everything. Are you hearing that one a lot as well? And what do you think of this idea that, you know, well, of content to replace advertising?
Yeah, I mean, now content, I think, is much more established, you know, and we have a big business in generating content. And I'd actually say that our content business at Saatchi & Saatchi is as big as our advertising business. Because actually it was very easy to move skills from persuasive advertising to engaging content. I mean, it wasn't a hard thing. All we had to crack was the ability to do it at high quality, low cost, and quick.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that took a while, but agencies like ours got there very quickly. I you know, where I get to on content is I think the case for content is unproven commercially. I think a lot of people are spending a lot of money and a lot of energy and effort creating stuff that's never seen or never seen by a sufficiently large number of people to make it worth having done it in the first place. I think there's a lot of bullshit talked about content driving earned media, where we've now realized that there is no such thing as earned media. Everything's paid for in one shape or form. And if you want your content to reach anybody online, you'll be paying for it in much the same way as you pay for advertising. So I'm very cynical about the content argument, though it clearly has, content has a role at different points in the purchase process, and it can be incredibly powerful close into the purchase to help people guide people through making the right purchase decision, what they need to know, all that sort of stuff. But I think, as with everything, you know, it's got its rightful place, but you know, nothing is the answer to everything. And I think one of the sad things about our industry over the last decade or so is that everything new that we've discovered, we've decided is the answer to everything. And I think there's an ecosystem. And I love, there's a book by a guy called Paul Feldwick, who was a long time planner at an agency called BNP in London. And he's written a book called The Anatomy of Humbug. Terrible title, but you know, in it he sort of advances the argument that that all of this is helpful to what we do. It is just a question of deciding when you use social, when you use content, when you use advertising, when you use sort of rational advertising, when you use emotional advertising. Everything has a place.
Yeah,
you know. So I feel cynical.
No,
you know, and I what's been weird, because I set out that on ad literate to be contrary, it sort of started being anti-advertising in 2005, and it was, you know, all about new media and then particularly the kind of purpose philosophy and brand building, and I find that, you know, now that, because that was new and unorthodox, and now I end up looking at, I mean, I really don't want to be Bob Hoffman. I don't want to be ad contrarian. I don't want to be a sad old git. He's not, but I don't want to be, you know, an old bloke whinging about new stuff. But I do find that now the edgy counter-orthodoxy is in saying all this stuff seems like it's unproven.
Yeah. But interestingly, purpose has also come back to the forefront of these days.
Like, yeah.
That's something that brands are starting to look at, and companies are starting to look at.
Yeah.
Or at least starting to put some proof behind it, I think, no?
Yes, it is. And I love it. And I've always loved it. And in the right place for the right brands, it can be incredibly powerful, but we have slightly swallowed the gospel according to Simon Sinek, and everything's about why. And you know, I did a project recently to a client, you're a how brand, not a why brand, and that's okay. You know, I think it's all right to have different solutions, and so I wrote a piece a little while ago saying I don't, you know, not every brand needs a purpose.
Yes,
some brands are purposeful. Some brands are just really good at what they do. I mean, going back to Dyson, lifelong love affair with that brand. I sort of think it doesn't have a purpose. It just is a really good vacuum cleaner. It does the job brilliantly. That's why I bought it. And I'm really happy with that. And I'll go and buy another one when this one breaks down.
Yeah, absolutely. Just conscious of time, so I usually finish with a few cool down questions.
Oh, God. Hopefully not about, you know, my childhood.
No. Well, I mean, we can talk about that, but they're slightly different. But I've got to have – it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, so I've got to have an ice cream question. Here's the question. What is a favorite food of yours that you think deserves to be made into an ice cream? That you haven't tried, obviously.
Yeah, well, I'm having an obsession with Vietnamese food at the moment. I mean, basically all of it. I mean, I just think anybody who decided to combine French cuisine with Asian cuisine is a genius. It's the best food form in the world. And I think banh mi ice cream is what
banh mi ice cream.
Yeah. That's what
that is something
for.
I have to talk about with my brother. You know, my brother is a chef. And no. My brother's a chef, and both my brothers are chefs.
Okay.
And he's about to open a new Asian restaurant in London. Okay. And I think a banh mi ice cream sounds like an interesting challenge because there's so many different flavors in there.
Yeah.
Very interesting. All right, cool. And another one that we were just talking about before we started recording is my interest in games.
Yeah.
And that you, after a conversation that we had when we met in Prague at the European Planning Conference,
yeah,
you got a couple of board games that you started playing with your family. Can you tell us a little bit more about the experience playing, Settlers of Catan, I think it is?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to thank you for that because, you know, it's very rarely you go to a planning conference and come away with a Christmas present for your eldest son and then latterly a birthday present for your younger son. So that was big value. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
You inspired me because I hadn't really ever grasped what was going on in tabletop gaming and that it got kind of, it was getting very exciting and interesting. And so we bought Settlers of Catan and we love it. I mean, we play it every weekend, and we've sort of got to that stage where we're doing bespoke setups and trying to figure out kind of the intricacies of the gameplay. What I love about it is for me, most board games in my life start off interesting and sort of tail off, and in the end, you end up just giving up playing that game of Monopoly, whatever it is. And I love the way Catan builds to this sort of crescendo of frenzied excitement. And we're also playing Pandemic, which is a cooperative game, and it's great to sort of sit down with the family. And I mean, of a Sunday evening and cure 4 global diseases. It feels like an achievement.
Yes.
Before bedtime.
Before bedtime.
So I'm excited about that. You inspire me. There's one you talked about called Zombicide, which I think for my eldest, I figured out it was a bit much for my younger son, but that's what I want to get next.
It's a big one that can last for a long time.
Okay.
The games can last for a long time. Pandemic's really, really long.
But Pandemic... quick, it's quick. I mean, I think people imagine board games, shit, you've got to have 4 hours.
Yeah.
Pandemic, 45 minutes. You know, we're playing it at the moment to make it last a bit longer because it genuinely feels a bit quick. But
actually, we were talking about like what happened to make these new board games into a trend. And I think a new type of design to make the games shorter is also a trend that is that it's worthwhile to change this whole thing of like board games taking 4 hours at like massive scale.
Yeah,
a lot more of them are very, very short. Escape is another one that might be worth checking out in a very, very short time frame. It's kind of like there's different themes, but one of them is a kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you're adventurers in the thing, and it's timed. You have like two minutes, so you have to go super fast and help each other to get out of this kind of temple thing, which is quite good fun as well.
No, and I think maybe there's something we can learn there about time time relevance. Or, I mean, we played Pandemic on Wednesday evening, you know, because school night, because it's sort of done in 45 minutes and popped off to cook tea after that, you know. But actually, I mean, for me, there's something going on. We'll figure it out about the gameplay, which you're sort of not really getting in kind of online gaming quite in the same way. There's a depth of gameplay I think is extraordinary.
Absolutely. Great. Thank you very much for having this conversation. So people can find you online on your website. It's AdLiterate.
Yep.
And on that's your Twitter handle as well, right?
AdLiterate. Yeah, that's right. More the merrier.
Are you going to be speaking at any events or anything that people can see you at in a short
time? Do you know what? No, so this is an invitation. I'd love to be doing more this year. At the moment, there's not much planned in.
Okay, cool. Perfect.
Thank you. Great. Really enjoyed that. Yeah. Brilliant.
All right, another episode gone. That was a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for listening to the end. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, how about sharing it with a friend? That's what I asked. All I want is for more people to listen to the show, really. And if you've enjoyed it, just tell somebody else about it. There's got to be somebody else you know who works with brands or marketing or advertising or just might enjoy the fun conversation that we had or maybe went to Cambridge. Go figure. I have no idea. Who just, you know, send them a link to the file by email or share it on your favorite social network and put it on Twitter, put it on Facebook. There's probably buttons for that somewhere, wherever you're listening. Or ideally, just make it a personal note. If you know one person in particular who's going to be enjoying it, then send them just, you know, I guess an email, right? Of course, you can always find more Ice Cream for Everyone goodies, stuff to read, stuff to listen to. So I usually comment about marketing in my blog, but of course there's the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter. That's the main thing I've been putting a lot of time and effort in lately, aside from the podcast. And as I said at the beginning, they're a collection of kind of more long form essay-ish. I mean, I don't dare saying it's an essay because really I go from personal memories and try to make connections with different things I'm interested in. They're published on medium.com, but you really get them first via email and you can register on the main website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. I'm just finishing a contract at the moment. So if ever you're looking for strategic advice, marketing advice, for your brand, for your business, or just want to talk about a bunch of different ideas, talk about games, because that's one thing I really love talking about. And I'm working on my own game designs on the side. I don't know. Well, I don't have no idea when that's going to come out. It's coming like working on it slowly, slowly. So yeah, follow all the updates on the Facebook page for Ice Cream for Everyone or on Twitter. I'm at HippoWill. And, I guess that's about it for now. There's going to be another episode coming out very soon. More exciting episodes coming out. So look out for that and have a fantastic end of, you know, whatever it is, morning, day, evening, night. Have fun and, see you soon. Bye.